Okay, good evening, everyone. Let's begin. If you don't have a sheet, there should be sheets right by the entranceway, right by the chair set up by the door. I want to thank the sponsors of this evening's shiur, to thank Yaakov Mordechai and Chana Steinman for sponsoring the shiur in memory of Chana's father, Tzvi Hirsch Ben Yisrael, Harry Bush. We should hope that in the merit of our communal Talmud Torah, neshama will have an aliyah. So we begin with a very interesting pasuk. It's actually a pasuk from last week's parsha. Number one, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, actually, excuse me, 2 weeks ago in Parsha Shmos, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God is speaking to Moshe by the burning bush, by the sneh, and God says, V'nasata eschein ha'am hazeh b'enei Mitzrayim, v'haya kiseh leichun lo selchu reikam. See, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of course, is giving Moshe Rabbeinu the future vision of how everything is going to unfold. And it is here that God says to Moshe, not only are the people going to go free, but when they go free, they will not leave empty-handed. V'sha'ala isha mishchenta u'migaras besa klei kesef u'klei zahav u'smalos v'samtem al b'neichem v'al b'noseichem v'nitzaltem es mitzrayim. Okay, so the word v'sha'ala means... I'll give you a hint. The translation's right on the sheet. Right? So interestingly enough, the way many of the commentaries translate this particular phrase is borrow. Like a shoel. A shoel in halacha is someone who borrows an object. Just keep this in mind. We go fast forward now to number two. Vayomer Hashem Moshe. This is this week's parsha. God says to Moshe, Od nega echad avi al paro va'al Mitzrayim. I'm sorry. So back to number one, just for a moment. So God here is telling Moshe Rabbeinu that when they leave Mitzrayim, they will not leave empty-handed. V'sha'ala isha mishchenta. Literally, a woman will ask slash borrow from her neighbor silver, gold, clothing, and they will accumulate so much wealth upon leaving Egypt that what? V'samtem al b'neichem u'b'noseichem. They will not even be able to hold it themselves. They'll have to place it on their children. Not only they need more than their children, they actually need their donkeys to carry out all the wealth. V'nitzaltem es Mitzrayim. And they were literally empty out Egypt. They will leave Egypt bereft of all of its wealth. Number two. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, Od nega echad avi al paro v'al Mitzrayim, acharichin yishalach eschem mizeh, kishalcho kaloi garish yigarish eschem mizeh. So here God telling Moshe Rabbeinu, this is after the Makkah, after the plague of Choshech, of darkness, God tells Moshe, there is going to be one plague, and this one more plague, and this plague is going to be so severe that afterwards you won't even have to ask Pharaoh to leave, but Pharaoh will ask you to leave. And therefore, says God to Moshe, "Daber na ba'aznei ha'am, v'yishalu ish me'es re'ehu, v'isha me'es re'usa, klei kesef uklei zahav." Here we see it again. Therefore, instruct the people, v'sha'ala, that same word. Tell them to ask slash borrow from their neighbor, or to borrow. Right? Go ahead, tell them to ask or to borrow from their neighbor. Gold and silver. Last pasuk in number three. This is when it's actually all occurring. See here, in perhaps one of the most riveting psukim in the Torah, it's amazing. You know, you spend 210 years in slavery, and then you would assume that emancipation would be gradual. But emancipation is not gradual. What happens? Like that. Like that. You gotta go. And you have to go so quickly that, as we know, there's not even time to allow for the dough to rise. Just as an aside, an incredible lesson in life. Most real life change is not gradual. Most real life change actually happens in a moment. If you think about the most significant changes that happen in life, there are some changes that build up over days, weeks, years, but there are certain things that totally change the course of existence, and those things usually occur within a moment. So Am Yisrael become a free people, not over time, but in a moment. And that moment comes so quickly that there's not even time to allow the dough to rise. So he goes on. Therefore, Vahashem na ubnei Yisrael asu kidvar Moshe, vayishalu mimitzrayim klei kesef uchlei zahav usmalos. And the Jewish people follow the directive of Moshe Rabbeinu, and vayishalu, again, same thing. Ask slash borrow silver and gold and clothing. Vahashem nasan eschina am beinei Mitzrayim, vayash ilum vayinastu es Mitzrayim. God places the favor of the nation in the eyes of the Egyptians, and literally they lent them, using the translation over here, and they emptied out or despoiled all of Egypt. So, as you could see by the bolded words, the Torah employs the same word, v'sha'al, in three different situations. In number one, where God is foreshadowing the future events that are going to occur to the Jewish people. In number two, when God actually conveys the command to Moshe to tell the people to ask the Egyptians for wealth. And in number three, when the Jewish people actually go ahead and ask their Egyptian neighbors for wealth. What I want to bring up, the question I want to raise, is why does the Torah use a word that can be so easily misunderstood? Because as you see over here, I just want to point out the translation that I used for these psukim is a translation that's found in the Judaica press, also found in the Art Scroll, and it's gleaned from many of the Mefarshim who understand the word v'sha'al to mean borrow. Did the Jewish people borrow wealth from Egypt? Absolutely not. They took it. No, and they took it, and they kept it. So therefore, we have to ask why the Torah, which is so careful with its wording, why would the Torah use a word that would convey to the reader a false impression of borrowing? Lest you think that this word was not misunderstood, look at number four. An amazing Gemara in Meseches Sanhedrin. The Gemara says, Pam achas bo'u b'nei Yitzrayim ladun im Yisrael lifnei Alexandrus Mukdon. One time an Egyptian delegation called the Jewish people, not just like a couple of Jews, the Jewish people, to a court case, to a hearing in front of Alexander Mokdon. Who was Alexander Mokdon? Alexander the Macedonian, Alexander the Great. So the Egyptian delegation called the Jewish people for a hearing in front of Alexander the Great. What was the claim? Amrulo, Harehu Omer, Vahashem Nasan Eschein Ha'am Be'enei Mitzrayim, Vayashilum, Tenu Lanu Kesef V'Zahav, Shenat Halta Mimenu. And the claim of the Egyptian delegation was, your own Torah says that you borrowed our gold and silver from us. Well, we are here to reclaim it. Pay it back. By the way, this wasn't a joke. This was a real hearing from Alexander the Great. You don't waste Alexander the Great's time. Right? They're coming. We want to collect that money that's owed to us. Reparations. Amar, Gavia ben Pesis Lechacham. So it was a particular sage who wasn't one of the ranking sages, named Gavia ben Pasya, ben Pesisa, excuse me. So Gavia ben Pesisa says to the ranking sages, Tenuli Rishus, the Elech Va'adon Imohem Lifnei Alexandros. Im Yinatzchuni, Amru Lahem, Hed Yod Shebanu Nitzachtem, Ve'im Anyen Atzeach Osam, Amru Lahem, Toras Moshe Rabbeinu Nitzachtem. So Gavia ben Pesisa has a good offer. He says like this. He says, let me debate the Egyptian delegation. If I lose, you guys could always say, ah, Gavia ben Pesisa, he's a lightweight. He's a rabbinic lightweight. Let us send someone who could really refute your arguments. And if I win, I don't even want any of the credit. You could simply ascribe all the credit to the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. So Gavia ben Pesisa comes, meets the Egyptian delegation in front of Alexander the Great, and he says the following. Amar lohen, mehechan atem mevi'in raya, amar lo min haTorah. So Gavia ben Pesisa said, tell me, where are you bringing your proof from that we owe you all of this money? And they responded, we're bringing it from your own Torah. To which Gavia ben Pesisa responds, amar lohen, af ani lo avi lechem raya el min haTorah. I'll also bring your proof from the Torah. What does the Torah say? U'moshav b'nei Yisrael sheyoshu mitzrayim shloshim shana v'arbamei oshana. Gavia ben Pesisa says, well, the same Torah says that we were enslaved for 430 years, which Rashi explains means from the time that God made the covenant with Avram, the Bris Ben Avsarim, until this point, was 430 years. But we'll go with the straight reading of the text. We were enslaved for 430 years. Says Gavia ben Pesisa, fine, let's work out the math. We were enslaved for 430 years. There were 600,000 men. So you owe us back wages for 600,000 men for 430 years. So the Egyptian delegation says, Tenu lanu, excuse me, Amar lanu Alexander smokto, nechzor lo tshuva. So the Egyptian delegation was speechless. He says, you got to answer them. Amru lo, Tenu lanu zman shlosha yamim. The Egyptian delegation said, give us 3 days to think about a retort. Nostan lohem zman, batku v'lo matzu tshuva. They took the 3 days. They could not find an answer to the Jewish, to the claim of Gvia ben Pasisa. But what's the point of this Gemara? The point of this Gemara is that clearly this very pasuk was used against us by later generations of the Egyptians. So once again, we must ask our fundamental question of why does the Torah choose to use the word v'sha'alah? Again, you saw it in 3 different instances. Sha'alah, vayish'alu, and vayish'alu, all 3 times, a word that could mean ask, but a word that could also be translated as borrow. Why would the Torah use a word that could be translated in an erroneous fashion and convey perhaps an erroneous understanding of the text? That's our first question. Second question is something that's also quite fascinating. If I were to ask you, what is the difference between the command in 1, 2, and 3? How do they differ? 2 out of the 3 are the same, 1 is different. I'm sorry? First one, good. If we have time, we're going to come back to that. What else? Female. What about there's a substantive difference? Excellent. Excellent. When God speaks to Moshe by the burning bush, he tells Moshe they're going to ask for silver, gold, clothing. In number 2, Moshe says, when Moshe commands the people, he talks to them about silver and gold. And in number 3, when the Jewish people actually do the asking, they ask for silver, gold, clothing. So we could ask why Moshe Rabbeinu omitted the clothing from his command, but that's not what we're going to focus on. Instead, what you're going to focus on is what is the meaning of the clothing, right? Meaning, if it would have just said, well, let me ask you this. When the Torah says, Kesef and Zahav, gold and silver, so how do you understand that phrase?
Wealth.
So does it mean just gold and silver? No, it means that they're going to go to the Egyptians, they're going to take items of value. When we say silver and gold, they're just examples of valuable items. And if it wouldn't have said smalot, if it wouldn't have said clothing, I would have perhaps also understood they were going to take some clothing as well. Why does the Torah, why does God in number 1 feel it necessary to impress upon Moshe Rabbeinu that the people are going to take the silver, the gold, and the clothing? And why is it that despite the fact that Moshe omitted the clothing, the people on their own still ask the Egyptians for clothing? In other words, what is the importance of clothing in this newfound wealth of the Jewish people? So these are our 2 fundamental questions for tonight. Number 1, why does the Torah use the lashon of she'ela, which could be misunderstood as borrowing? And number 2, what is the importance or what is the significance of clothing in this new acquisition of Jewish wealth? So let's focus on the first question of the She'ela. So we'll present a couple of answers to this. The first is the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra writes, and this perhaps is the simplest answer. The Ibn Ezra writes, V'yesh mis'oninim v'omrim ki avosinu ganovim hayu. There are those who cry out and complain, and they say that our forefathers were thieves. Why were we thieves? Because we borrowed gold, silver, and clothing, and we never gave it back. V'elu haloyiru ki mitzvah elyona haisa. So says the Ibn Ezra, but this is what God told us to do. V'ein tam lishol lama. And therefore, we have no right to ask why. Ki Hashem bara hakol, God created everything. V'hu nasan osher l'misha yirtzeh, he gives wealth to who he wants to. V'yikachena miyado, and he could choose to take back that wealth. V'yitnenu l'achar, and give it to someone else. V'ein zera, and this is not bad. Why? Ki akol shalohu, because everything belongs to God. Or in other words, the answer to the Ibn Ezra's answer is, God told me to do it. God told me to do it. All right. So if God told me to do it, and remember, the Ibn Ezra is actually going with the understanding that the word she'ela means borrow, Which means that according to the Ibn Ezra, when the Jewish people came to their Egyptian neighbors, they said, can I borrow your gold, silver, and clothing? That's a lie. You're not borrowing it, you're taking it. Says the Ibn Ezra, that's what God told us to do, and case closed. There's nothing more to discuss. We could end here, if you want, but all right. We'll go on. Number six. So the Ibn Ezra then goes ahead and presents another issue, or another approach. He says the following, Ubios Yisrael Krovin Lotzeis, as the Jewish people were gearing up and getting ready to leave Egypt, V'sha'Allah, so they go ahead and they quote-unquote borrow from their neighbors. V'lulei Shenasan Hashem Lohem Hachem, Lohayu nosnim lohem klum. Remember, this is our second approach. The second approach that Ibn Ezra says, that the truth is, had God not given us, had not allowed us to find favor in the eyes of the Egyptians would have given us nothing. Vida ki davar gadol haya. Right? Remember, as much as the Egyptians were happy to see us go, but the thing that they were going to give us their wealth, says the Ibn Ezra, would not have happened through natural means. Vitzadikim gimurim hayu Yisrael, Shelo galu hasod, v'hu sheparu chashu adivrei Moshe derach shloshes yomim, sheyelchu v'yishol mitzrayim. So here the Ibn Ezra brings up something very interesting, which is, this is not the first example of somewhat misleading speech. Right? We have earlier examples of this. Where's the first example? Where Moshe Rabbeinu originally says to Paro what? Nelcha derech shloshes yomim. We just want to go out for a couple of days, with the assumption that we're going to come back. Says the Ibn Ezra, it's interesting to note that throughout this story, we have a number of statements like this that, to be honest, on their surface level, look like falsehoods. So Moshe Rabbeinu telling Paro, only going to go for 3 days when they have no intentions of coming back. The Jewish people, quote unquote, borrowing the wealth of the Egyptians when they have no intention of returning it. So says the Ibn Ezra, what's happening over here? He says, V'chalila, I'm in number six, third line in, V'chalila shahanavi diber kazav. The Navi didn't lie. Kilo amr li olam nashuv, V'chachmas Hashem niskava mida'atenu. God's wisdom is above ours. What does that mean? V'asher nira li, shahaya zehad davar ba'avur shnei dvarim. Ha'echud, sheyitnu lahem klei kesef klei zav. Number one, says the Ibn Ezra, the Egyptians would not have parted with their wealth voluntarily. So therefore, the only way to get their money was how? Was how? Say it like it is. To lie. To lie. To lie. How are you allowed to lie? So the answer is, you are allowed to lie in certain situations. And especially in the situations where God himself tells you that you have to lie. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, look, they're not going to give it to you willingly. You are entitled to it. And therefore tell them you're going to borrow it. Okay. And he goes on. There's another reason as well. He says, V'ilu yadu shlo yashuvu, lo hayonostim. Meaning, had they not thought that we were going to return, they would have never given us their wealth. V'hadavar hasheni, sheyitva paro v'chelo. There's something deeper. There's something deeper. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is setting the Egyptians up for what will be the final stage of redemption at the Red Sea. Why do the Egyptians chase the Jewish people? Because they feel that they have been deceived, right? The Torah says that it's only after 6 days go by that Paro realizes that, hey, they're not coming back. 3 days go by. That, hey, they're not coming back. Right? Because remember, in Paro's mind, even when they left, and again, even when left with all this wealth, he thinks they're coming back. The Egyptians lent their wealth to the Jewish people, assuming that they're coming back. After they realized they're not coming back, this infuriated them, and they set off in hot pursuit of the Jewish people. This pursuit was necessary. Why? In order that God could bring about final salvation at the Red Sea. He says, He says, "Va'adavar sheni sheyitpa paro v'chelo ki ilu hayu holchim birshuso ve'ein belibo sheyashuvu lo rodav achareihem." He says the Ebn Ezra, it's all one picture, because had Paro thought that they were coming back, had Paro thought that they were leaving forever, had the Egyptians thought that they had just parted ways with their wealth, the incentive to run after the Jewish people would not have been there. But because Moshe planted the seed in Paro's mind that we're only going for 3 days, and because the Jewish people planted the seed that we're coming back because they only, quote unquote, borrowed the wealth, that set the trap, so to speak, that laid the groundwork, that laid the foundation for the Egyptian pursuit of the Jewish people, which was a necessary piece in order to bring everyone to the Yam Suf. Because it was only at the Red Sea, when the waves come crashing down on the Egyptians, and the Egyptian empire is really decimated, that Jewish salvation is complete. So according to the Ibn Ezra, HaKadosh Baruch Hu charges Moshe and the Jewish people with employing somewhat questionable means in order to go ahead and bring about the final divine salvation. Just so you know, as we all know, this is not the first time that we see a concept like this, that God charges man with employing almost an uncomfortable set of means in order to bring about a particular result. Yaakov Avinu did this, others have done this, so this is a continuation of that. That's our second approach. Now a third approach, Rabbeinu Bachya number 7. So Rabbeinu Bachya writes the following. He says, V'sha'ala Isha, V'sha'ala Isha Mishchenta. Everybody, right? Again, same question in terms of borrowing. Chas v'shalom, she'yatira kadosh baruch hu lignov das abrios, she'yishalu mehem klei kesef uklei zav, v'lo yashivu lahem. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, there's absolutely no way that God would ever want us to say something deceptive to another individual. He would never want us to go ahead and lie. Aiba, what about the fact that the word v'sha'alah actually means to borrow? To which the Rabbeinu Bachya responds, avaloshon v'sha'alah hu shetitin lahen b'matana. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, you guys are all mistranslating the word. The word v'sha'alah means what? Sha'alah literally means what? Ask. So what is HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying? Don't just go in and grab the gold and grab the silver and grab the clothing. Ask. Be nice. Be cordial. Make sure you have midos, even though you're entitled to this wealth, all that back wages. But you make sure that you maintain your human dignity, even in the face of your former oppressor. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, everybody's getting all excited because they're mistranslating the word. V'sha'alah does not mean to borrow. So understand, now we don't have to get into both Ibn Ezra's. Remember, Ibn Ezra in approach one said what? How do we deal with the word v'sha'alah? Quick review. God told us to do it. That's it. I know it looks shady. I know it looks like a lie. It looks dishonest. It doesn't matter. That's what God told us to do, and we simply don't have the right to question. Ibn Ezra in approach number two said, right? This was necessary in order to lay the trap for the Egyptians to pursue the Jewish people to Yam Suf. Says Rabbeinu Bachya, you're all getting excited for no reason. The word v'sha'alah just means to ask. You know, there's an amazing idea. Rabbi Soloveitchik brings down this incredible concept. He says that if you look at the Exodus story, if you look at it, it's essentially the first recorded slave rebellion. The first recorded slave rebellion. So the Rav says, but this slave rebellion is unlike any other slave rebellion throughout history. Slave rebellions were always marked by what? Violence, uncontainable violence. When the former servants were finally given the opportunity to have an upper hand over their masters, they were merciless. How did the Jewish people celebrate their first night of freedom? How did they celebrate? Inside the house. They didn't even party in the streets. Right? They stayed inside the house. HaKadosh Baruch Hu forced them to exhibit restraint. Why? Because God understood that it is so easy for the former slave to become as tyrannical and as evil as his former master. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to rise above all of that. So says Rabbeinu Bachya, what is God telling Moshe Rabbeinu by the snare? What does Moshe Rabbeinu command the Jewish people? And what do the Jewish people ultimately carry out? Vayishalu. Ask, hello, Mr. Egyptian. I know our relationship didn't get off to a good start. For the last 210 years, things have been a little bit difficult. I wish you much hatzlacha in the future. And maybe there's a little tzedla derech, a little something you want to give me as a going away present. Right? So vayishalu. Vayishalu, talk like a mensch. Talk nicely. Don't demand it. Ask. Okay, the Rashbam says in number 8, and the Rabbeinu Bachya, by the way, goes on to explain. He gives multiple, I cut the Rabbeinu Bachya short, but the Rabbeinu Bachya gives multiple other examples where the word sha'al means to ask for a gift, not to borrow. The Rashbam in number 8, same thing. V'sha'ala isha mishchenta b'matana gimura v'chaluta. What are they asking? Not to borrow, they're asking for a bona fide, unrefundable gift. Shahari Kasuv Rasati Eschina Am Zeha. Okay, number 9, the Kliyaka writes, same thing. Yesh Mefarshim She'ela Zu Eina Lashon Halva, Ki Ech Yitzan Hashem Ledaber Sheker, Velikach Ba'arma Elohumi Lashon Sha'al Ve'etne Elohim. Kliyaka again, it can't, Sha'al can't mean to borrow, because if it means to borrow, that means God instructed the people to speak a falsehood to the Egyptians, and God would not command us that. Finally, Rav Hirsch in number 10 really brings this home and says the following. He says in a much more dramatic fashion. He says, this word, v'sha'ala, sha'al, has an unfortunate history. He says, listen to this, it occurs at least a few hundred times in Tanakh, and there, it always has the meaning to demand, to request, to obtain by entreaty. Never to borrow. In one single instance alone, it is used for borrowing. And this one single instance, because it just happens to describe a legal relationship. And in consequence, the word shal has become in all current laws referring to a borrower. See, here Rav Hirsch said, I'm going to give you the proof that for shal doesn't mean to borrow. Hundreds of times it appears throughout Tanakh. And only one of those times does it ever mean to borrow. So again, our third approach is the question is not really a question. Because the word v'sha'al doesn't mean to borrow. There's no discomfort over here. There's no half-truths over here. V'sha'al means to ask. HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructing the Jewish people, ask the Egyptians for their wealth. This continues an already established pattern of behavior that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is expecting of us, that even in those first few moments of freedom, where the former slave would be most prone to taking vengeance on his master, HaKadosh Baruch Hu demands of us that we exhibit a constant and unequivocal sense of midos. Okay. Now we come to our fourth approach. So the fourth approach is going to, we're going to have to take a little bit of a detour. So if you look in number 11, V'chizkuni says something amazing. V'chizkuni writes, Lo selchu rekam, ki heim ya'aniku lochem megimo minim. So the V'chizkuni writes, this is earlier, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is commanding Moshe, this is by the burning bush, where God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, that not only are they going to go free, but they won't go free empty-handed. So writes the V'chizkuni, what does it mean they won't go free empty-handed? Ki heim ya'aniku lochem migimol minim. Literally, the Egyptians will provide you with three different types of wealth. Kesef, silver, zahav, gold, smalot, clothing, lekayin, yeitzu berchush gadol, in order to fulfill the Abrahamic promise that the Jewish people will not just be freed from slavery, but will go out with great wealth. Dugmas ha'anokas eved, tzon, goren, v'yakev. And the Chizkuni references this dynamic to a halacha that we find in Chumash Devarim. The concept of ha'anaka, the concept that when a Hebrew servant goes free, his master has an obligation to share with his servant some of his own material wealth. Take a look at number 12. You can see the psukim inside. So the Torah writes the following, Ki mocher lecha achicha ha'ivri, o ha'ivriya, v'abdecha sheishanim, u'bashona ha'shviyis tishalchenu chafshim mi'imach. So the Torah says that if you purchase a Hebrew servant, or for whatever reason a Hebrew servant comes into your possession, he will work for you for 6 years, and in year number 7 he goes free. And when you emancipate him, you may not emancipate him empty-handed. Right? You can't set him free empty-handedly. You have to send him off with something. What should you do? Hanek taniklo mitzoncha umigarncha umiyikvecha. Provide for him from your sheep, from your granary, and from your wine press, which are examples of your material wealth that God has blessed you with. Titemlo. You have to give it to your servant. Why? V'zacharta ki eved hayisa be'eretz Mitzrayim. Because remember that you were once a servant in Egypt. V'yiftecha Hashem Elokecha. God redeemed us. And of course in parentheses, and He sent us out with wealth. Al kin anuchi mitzavecha es hadavar hazeh hayom. Therefore, I am commanding you to do this day. So, what's the nature? What is the purpose of this mitzvah? We call this ha'anaka. Ha'anaka means that when you set your servant free, you must give him, you must share with him some of your own personal wealth to kind of put him on his feet again. So why do I have to do this? So the Sefer Achinuch in number 13 gives a very interesting approach. The Sefer Achinuch writes, Mishrashe HaMitzvah, at the root of this mitzvah, is L'man Nikne B'Nafshenu Midos Mu'ulos Yikaros V'Chamudos. According to the Sefer Achinuch, who is the true beneficiary of ha'anaka, of giving your servant the money? The master. Why, says the Sefer HaChinuch? Because by doing this, we ingrain within ourselves incredible, beautiful, and precious midos. V'im ha'nefesh ha'yikara v'ha'me'ula nizkeh l'tov. And with a sensitive and refined soul, we will accomplish great things. V'hakel hatov chafetz lehitiv la'amo. God desires to do good unto His people. V'hodanu v'edanu shenarachim amisha avadosanu v'nasalanu mishalanu b'toras chesed milvad mashes ninu imola seislo bischaro v'davar muskol hu v'ein tzorech laharich bo. So Sefer HaChinuch says something fascinating. He points out that the real reason you have to give to your Eved is not for the Eved, but it's for me, the master. Why? Because if you think about it, the notion of taking, remember, an Eved, whether we want to admit it or not, as much as an Eved Ivri, a Hebrew servant, a Jewish servant, is a full-fledged Jew, but someone who was an Eved was definitely a different station in life, a different station in society. So the idea of giving something of mine, sharing something of mine with someone who perhaps society would consider to be a rung beneath me on the social ladder, is one of the most incredible acts of chesed and self-refinement. And a person who is able to do this is a person whose soul will be receptive to future spiritual greatness. Says the Sefer HaChinuch, the beneficiary is not as much the Eved as much as it is me, the Adam. But perhaps there's another way to understand this mitzvah. You know, what's intriguing is the word or the phraseology of ha'anaka. Right? What other words resemble ha'anaka, share at least the same basic root? What? Right? So number one is anak, giant. What else? Laha'anik, meneket, to nurse. So perhaps we could suggest the following idea. Ha'anik, ta'anik, lo. Right? This idea of ha'anaka is related both to the anak, to the giant, and to the meineket, the nursing. What's going on? When a person is an eved, it is so easy for them to lose their sense of humanity and begin to look at themselves as a piece of property, as chattel. As much as there are so many halachos, so many laws that govern how you treat your servants. That's why I'm often uncomfortable with translating the word eved as a slave. Because when we think about slavery, we think about oppression. But the truth is, if you look at the halachos governing how you have to treat an eved, you know, the most classic example the Gemara says is what? Right, the Adon has, you have one pillow in the house. So who gets the pillow? The eved. The servant, right? The halacha goes out of its way to maintain the dignity of the servant. In fact, the Gemara actually says that kol mi shekana eved, kana rabo. You think you acquired a servant? You really acquired a master. Why? Because in certain ways, you have to treat him better then you treat yourself. Even if you're willing to forgo and forgive certain things, you can't do that for the Eved. But nevertheless, as much as the halacha may strive to ensure that the Eved is treated fairly and equitably and never feels like a piece of property, it's inevitable that someone who spends years as an Eved could lose his sense of humanity, could begin to forget that he is a person, and begin to think of himself as just a possession, as a piece of chattel, just like all the other things that the Adon owns. So perhaps what the Torah is telling us is the following, that part of the emancipation process, let's see it a little bit differently, it's not just enough to free your Eved from servitude. It's not just enough to, so to speak, you know, unlock the proverbial shackles. It's not just to say you're free to go on your own. The Torah is telling us that when you emancipate your Eved, you are obligated to rehumanize him. You are obligated to do whatever is within your power to once again make him feel like a full-fledged human being. Again, what's the word that the Torah uses? Ha'anaka. You have to mother him. You have to nurture him. You have to nurse him back to humanity in order that what? He could feel like what? Like an anak. In order that ultimately he could once again feel great about himself. It's not just enough to say, Shkayach, you're free, have a great life. Hanik ta'aniklo. You must nurse him back to humanity. You must rehumanize him. You must endow him once again with that sense of self. You must make him realize that you're not chattel. You are a person. You must make him feel great. You must make him feel like an anak. How do you do this? Well, on the most basic level, the way you do it is by giving him possessions. Right? The most basic way you do this is by making him feel like a free man, in that now he has ownership. I think I actually mentioned this at a shiur, I don't remember when. Rav Soloveitchik quotes, I definitely quoted this sometime recently, I apologize for the repetition, but it's one of my favorite ideas by the Pesach Seder. The Rav quotes, you know, we begin the Seder with Halach Ma'anya. With Halach Ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction. So what do we see? We make a declaration during Halach Ma'anya. And we say, Kol Dichfin Yesei Ve'yechol. Whoever's hungry, come and eat. Come and join me. What's the problem with that statement? Right? So first of all, it's one thing if you're going to say that at the beginning of the Seder. But I'm not. I'm already one cup into the Seder. Number two, who am I saying it to? The people that are on my table. Well, I'm assuming the people that are on my table are pretty sure that I'm going to feed them already. Right? So what's the point of that declaration? So the Rav points out something amazing. Rav Soloveitchik explains that a servant cannot perform the mitzvah of hachnasas arachim. He can't invite guests. He can't have company. Why? Because he owns nothing. So says the Rav, you're right. Is it a real declaration, come and eat? No. It's a statement about my emancipation. I own things. I own things. So now I could invite you for a meal. I could technically go out and scream out into the street, whoever needs a place to eat, come to me. Why? Because on the most basic level, the basic expression of freedom is ownership of property, ownership of possessions. When you have something to your name, that is the most objective statement of freedom. So therefore the Torah says, Ha'anik ta'anik lo, nurse him, nurture him, mother him back, rehumanize him, make him feel great. How? Migarncha, mitzoncha, umiyikvecha. Give him some property. Give him some stuff. Make sure he has a couple of dollars in his wallet. Let him feel a little bit of at least material security. That's the first step in the rehumanization process. If we take this approach, remember, so I just want to point out, remember how we got here? Of course not, right? How did we get here? Because the Chizkuni was the one who explained back in number 11 that the whole concept of giving the people wealth was a form of ha'anaka. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe, they're going to get kesef, zahav, and smalot, and clothing. Why? Just like the Hebrew servants will get in the future hanaka, this is their ha'anaka. So perhaps now we could have a new understanding of what is really unfolding over here. When the Jewish people are leaving Egypt, there's one major thing that they need from the Egyptians. And what is that? They need validation of their humanity. For the last 210 years, you treated us like property. For the last 210 years, you used us, you abused us. For the last 210 years, you tossed our children into the Nile like they were not fit to live. So Am Yisrael, now getting ready to leave Egypt, need one thing from the Egyptians: a validation and a recognition of their humanity. Show me that you understand that I am a fellow human being. Show me that you understand that I am not a piece of property. Show me that you understand that I am not chattel. What they need most at this moment is a rehumanization that the Egyptians and only the Egyptians can give them. Now, it's interesting to note is that often man can't do this on his own. Remember, God is the one who prompts us to go ahead and do this with our servant. And look what happens in Egypt. If you look at number 14, so I quoted to you over here a beautiful piece from Nechama Leibowitz. So Nechama Leibowitz writes, "For an Israelite, the word Egyptian had the bitterest associations. It would not have been remarkable had the Jew hated the Egyptian as the enslaver of his ancestors, and would have reserved the right not to accord him the generous treatment enjoined by the Torah with regard to the stranger. But the Torah records, listen to this, that the Egyptians and Jews parted friends, the former liberally furnishing them with gifts as the latter themselves had bidden, in the case of sending away their own Hebrew servants. Consequently, thou shalt not abhor an Egyptian, for thou wert a stranger in his land. But since the Egyptians could not be expected to offer gifts on their own initiative, Israel was bidden to spur them to do it and say to them, let us part friends, and we'll take with us a parting gift." So according to this approach, understand what's happening over here. Vayish alu, according to approach number 4, actually means what? Really, it's in line with what Rabbeinu Bachya and what Rav Hirsch said before as well. Vayish alu means they asked nicely. I'm going to knock on the Egyptian door, and I'm going to ask nicely for kesef, for silver, for gold, and for clothing. And herein lies the ultimate test. Egyptian, how will you respond to me? Will you relate to me as a fellow human being, or will you relate to me as an object? It has to be Vayishalu. The Jewish people can't demand the property, because if they demand it, then the Egyptians might simply respond to the Jewish request out of fear. The response, the accommodation, or I should say the affirmative response, the giving of the wealth of Egypt, has to stem from the fact that the Egyptians now recognize the humanity of the Jewish people. I'm giving it to you because I recognize now that the person who I thought was a piece of property for the last 210 years is in fact a fellow human being. So what comes out is something amazing. This is not just about getting money. This is about a rehumanization process. The Jews can only leave Egypt once they feel human again. And they can only be made to feel human by the people who what? Dehumanize them to begin with. So what does the Torah say? So the Torah, interestingly enough, says, if you skip, you don't have to skip back, I'll skip back. But the Torah says in number 3 that God put the favor of the people in the eyes of the Egyptians. Vayash ilum. It's interesting. It's the reciprocal lashon. They asked, and the Egyptians vayash ilum. So what is vayash ilum? I mean, look at the Kli Yoker number 15. The Kli Yoker writes, Umash ne'emar vayash ilum, haynu shamitzrim hischilu litvoa mehen, sheyekablu mehen matonos kol kach motzuchin beineihem. Vayash ilum means what? They didn't even have to make the request. That as soon as they began talking, what did the Egyptians do? They wanted. they wanted to give to the people. They were urging the people to take more and more. What comes out according to this approach is that which Jewish people needed most, a validation and a recognition of their humanity, that we were people, not objects, comes in their final hour in Egypt by the Egyptians giving them the wealth, not out of compulsion, not because someone was banging down their door, not because of a threat, but because someone asked nicely and the Egyptians were given the opportunity to again validate and recognize the humanity of their former servants. Now, we could understand the clothing as well. If you remember again about 45 minutes ago, so we spoke about the clothing, right? What's up with the smalot? Why is this important? Let the Torah just simply say silver and gold, and then we would have understood it includes everything. Why does God have to go out of his way? Why do the Jewish people go out of their way to get clothing? See, interestingly enough, if you look at Rashi, in number 17, Rashi makes a dramatic statement. Well, in number 16, the Torah says that the Jewish people followed the command of Moshe. Vayishalu mimitzrayim, they asked the Egyptians for kesef, zahav, smalot, silver, gold, clothing. Look what Rashi writes in 17. Af hein hayu chashubos lahem min hakesef min hazav. What was the most important thing in the eyes of the people? Not the silver, not the gold, but the clothing. Vahamu'uchar bapasuk chashuv. Rashi understands that the Torah is speaking in a progression from least important to most important. So it's silver, gold, clothing being most important. Rabbeinu Bakhi, number 18, says the same idea. Klei kesef uklei zavu smalot, hamu'uchar bekasuv choshuv yoser. That which is mentioned later in the verse is more important. But why would clothing be the most important thing to acquire? So we have to understand, clothing serves a dual role. On one hand, clothing endows the wearer, if that's a word, but the wearer, right? Makes sense. Clothing endows the wearer with a positive self-image. Bless you. When you are wearing clothing that makes you feel good, for whatever reason it makes you feel good, you feel better not just about the way you look, but you feel better about yourself. As a person, clothing endows the wearer with a positive self-image. The second thing that clothing does is it allows others to form a positive initial impression about you. Whether we like to admit it or not, we all size people up immediately based on how they look. You'll notice the I didn't include it on the sheet. The Gemara actually makes an incredibly striking statement. The Gemara says that a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar, who walks around with a stain on his shirt, is chayiv misa, is liable to death. Why? Why? Because someone's going to see the Torah scholar, and he's going to see a stain on the shirt, and what are people going to say? Rabbis are slobs. Right, Rabbi, look, this is Torah? Torah looks like this. Torah is so disgusting. Torah is so fashmutzed. Why? Because that's how people work. We size up people, and again, it's not a bad thing. It's just realistic. It's the way life works. People forge their initial impressions about us, and we forge our initial impressions about each other by the way we look. So clothing again accomplishes this dual role. On one hand, it endows the wearer with a positive self-image, and also it allows me. Or it allows others to form an initial positive impression about me. Look at the Sefer HaChinuch in number 19, just to bring home both of these points. So the Sefer HaChinuch in 19 says the following. He writes, So here the Sefer HaChinuch in Parshas Truma is discussing why is it that the Kohen has to wear special clothing when he does the Avodah. Why does he have to wear special clothing when he does the avoda? Why can't he just wear whatever he wants, as long as it's nice, as long as it's neat, as long as it's clean? So look what the Sefer HaChinuch writes, 19, second paragraph. V'shrashe HaMitzvah, the essence is, HaYisod HaKavu Alanu, because the principle that we all know, Ki HaAdam Nif'al Lefi Pe'ulosav. because a person is influenced by his actions. Va'achareihem machshavosav v'kavanosav. And it is my actions that influence my thoughts and my kavanos, my intent. Va'ashliach ha-mechaper, the man who is in charge of bringing atonement upon the Jewish people, tzorech lahatfis kol machshavto v'kavanoso el ha-avoda. Says the Sefer HaChinuch something amazing. You know why the Kohen has to wear special clothing? Because it's the clothing that impresses upon the Kohen the importance of what he's doing. Because as they say, clothes makes the man. Our clothing influences how we feel about ourselves, what we are doing, what we are accomplishing, and where we are holding in life. Again, we're not talking about in a shallow way of somebody who only cares about their outer appearance, but it is clear that the outer appearance helps to form my impressions about myself. You know, there's a fascinating halacha. How often did the king have to get his hair cut? Every day. How often did the Kohen Gadol have to get his hair cut? Once a week. Once a week. So you see this absolutely amazing grooming. Shouldn't we say to ourselves, come on, the Melech and the Kohen Gadol, they should be so spiritual that the simple, mundane, physical grooming needs should simply not be important. Even if that's true that it's not important to you, guess what? It's important to everyone else, right? But it is important to you because if you feel good, if you realize that your clothing is a certain way, if you realize that your grooming is a certain way, that your hygiene is a certain way, that endows you with a sense of self-importance. Says the Sefer HaChinuch, the reason the Kohen has to wear this clothing is because it focuses him on his task. It reminds him about his important position and station. If you look at number 20, this helps to highlight the second aspect of clothing. This is a fascinating study. You can see, I put the website here, you can see the entire study, I only took one part of it. It was a study that was commissioned by this Dr. Reagan, who was from California State University. She wanted to see the impact of our clothing, what we wear on other people. So listen to this. She writes, a field experiment explored whether a female shopper's appearance would influence the customer service she received. Specifically, a female confederate, you know, accomplice, a female subject, someone who was in on the experiment, dressed in formal work clothes, skirt and blouse, or informal gym clothes, tights and t-shirt, entered a series of randomly selected women's clothing stores in a large mall and proceeded to shop. The amount of time that passed before an employee approached and acknowledged the confederate served as the dependent variable. Meaning the experiment was, is there going to be a difference the amount of time that it takes the sales clerk to approach a person based on how they're dressed? Look what Dr. Reagan found. As hypothesized, she was acknowledged significantly sooner when formally attired than when informally dressed. Thus clothing, like other aspects of appearance, influences how people are evaluated and treated by others. This is the other aspect of clothing. Yes, clothing on one level allows us to look at ourselves in a different way, but it also influences how other people, at least initially, view us as well. So now listen to this. What comes together is the following. The whole asking of riches from Egypt was more than just a fulfillment of the Abrahamic promise. As we have already established, it was necessary for the emotional healing and rehumanization of the Jewish people. Vayishalu, the first step is they have to ask for gold and silver, not demand, not threaten. Why? Because the Egyptian response to that simple, timid, pleasant, courteous request would really highlight how the Egyptians felt about the Jews at this moment. The Egyptian response, Vayash Ilum. They responded generously. They responded courteously. They responded nicely. They didn't just go out and throw the riches on and slam the door. So what happened? The rehumanization process was able to take place. The people, after having seen the fulfillment of all of God's promises, get something from the Egyptians that only the Egyptians could have given them, their human identity back. after being robbed of it for 210 years, those people that treated them worse than objects have now rehumanized them, have nursed them back to emotional health, have mothered them, have made them feel great. Ha'anik ta'anik lo. They need the clothing. Why do they need the clothing? Because now that they received or began this process of rehumanization by the Egyptian response, they needed to find a way to build themselves up in their own eyes as well. So how did that process begin? That's the smalot. That's the clothing. The clothing was important because by donning the clothing of the Egyptians, right? It wasn't just the clothing of the Egyptians. It was the clothing of who? Right? The clothing of the boss and the clothing of a free man. By donning free man's clothing, they allowed themselves to feel freer. The rehumanization by getting the gold and the silver, combined with the putting on of the free man's clothing, serves to emotionally rehabilitate them. Not only that, but then there's a second aspect of clothing, which is they now give off the appearance of free men to all who see them. So they begin to feel free, and by wearing the smalot, also begin to give off a message. They give a message of emancipation as well. So really, according to this fourth approach, again, something absolutely amazing. It's not just simply the fulfillment of the Abrahamic process, but all of what's unfolding over here is the rehumanization of the Jewish people, the validation of their humanity by the Egyptians, the donning of the clothing of free men gives them the identity of freedom and allows them to project the identity of freedom. And to close, I think one amazing, well, many, many, many amazing lessons, but one additional lesson comes out. If you remember, again, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu first approaches Moshe Rabbeinu by the Sneh, so he tells Moshe about the whole plan. Remember that salvation and emancipation doesn't end at when they leave Egypt. When does it really reach its pinnacle? When does it really, its zenith? When? At Matan Torah at Har Sinai. Right, that's really when it reaches its pinnacle. When we get to Har Sinai and we say Na'aseh Nisha HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us the Torah, that's when it really reaches its apex. So perhaps what the Torah is also trying to teach us is that in order to go ahead and achieve a state of spiritual health, man must first achieve a state of emotional health. If I don't feel emotionally healthy, if I don't feel good about who I am, what I am, then it is virtually impossible to find God. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, before he brings us back to Har Sinai, says, you have to remember what it's like to be people. We get a little bit from the Egyptians. They validate our humanity by donning the clothing. We validate that humanity for ourselves. We begin to project that humanity to others, beginning the process of rehumanization and preparing us for that awesome moment at Har Sinai. Step over here. Yes.
The gold and silver technique.